I'm Scott Tenona, Chair-Elect of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. This morning, we're going to jump right into singing. We're going to sing, hum, and do-do-do-do-do the refrain from Don't Worry, Be Happy 4 times. If it's not already impressed in your head forever, you'll get it very soon. So let's start with the hummy do-do-do's on three. Stand as you're able. 1, 2, 3. Do 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 do. Don't worry. Do 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 do. Be happy. Do 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 do. Don't worry. Be happy. Do do. If only it were that easy. Achieving happiness is not usually as straightforward as just not worrying and being happy. For that matter, it's not clear we all know what we really mean or want by happy. Today's service is on the topic of happiness. Dave Lambert, one of our resident economists, will be giving the sermon. If you're new to attending the fellowship, you should know that here at UUFM, we use a variety of different approaches to the things we do, the things we discuss. We have a pretty broad understanding of what religion means. Today's service picks up on a theme from earlier, which we're engaging on the economic analysis of things important to us. Draw your attention to the announcements over on this side. These are the things that structure our lives here at UUFM, bring us together, and let us join as a community. I am going to light the chalice, and when I light the chalice, it's going to be to recognize that all of us, wherever we are, whatever we believe, want happiness in one form for another. And I light it also to symbolize the hope that I have that we can all get closer to living flourishing and happy lives. Now is the moment in our service where we take a little bit of time to share joys and concerns of our lives, the things that are important that we feel that we want to bring out and share with the community. When we share burdens, they're lightened, and when we share joys, they're brighter.
Shirley Hobrock, this isn't a joy or concern, but I just missed getting an announcement up to the front. After the service today, back in the Alsop's room, anyone that brings their directory back there, we have the new one and the new pages to add. So if you'll bring your directories back, and any new people come back, and you can get a new directory. We'll be doing this for a few Sundays after the service.
Kathleen Tenona, I just wanted to share the joy that today is Rose's 5th birthday.
Yvonne Lacey, my great joy today is that our daughter, Jane McKinley, is visiting us from Boulder, Colorado for a few days. It is indeed a great joy.
Does that work? My name's Laura. I have a joy and a concern. My concern is that I very shockingly got fired recently from my longtime job. But the good thing is that it's fine. And oddly enough, a lot of my clients found a way to get a hold of me and contacted me, and I'm just doing stuff at my house, and I think I'm going to be able to expand that. Actually, things are really awesome. So it's like a really cool thing that it happened.
Wow.
I, too, miss the announcements, but I also miss getting this in the bulletin. I am very joyful to announce that our Helping Hands collection last week was $903.
Hi, Corey Zeller. I have two joys today. One is that Sloan's surgery went well on Thursday, and the second is that Thursday night we were here for soup supper in Sue's absence, and I just want to say thank you to everyone who came, and especially to Sybil Perkins, who offered so much help, both with food and with preparation and cleanup, to Jennifer Bryan, who provided lots of food, to Betty Banner for the pumpkin muffins. It was just such a lovely evening of fellowship, and I have increased appreciation for Sue and what she does every month. She's amazing. So thank you to everyone who came.
Hold those joys and concerns, both expressed and not, in our hearts. And now the choir. Hello. Good. If the kids would like to come up and join me for a children's conversation, I would love that. Feel free to sit on the stage, too. Good morning. Who likes to dance? Okay. Who doesn't like to dance? Maybe nobody. Who likes to dance but doesn't feel like doing it right now? Okay. So dancing makes you happy, but you don't want to do it right now. How would you feel, Indigo, if I said, I want you to dance right now? Do you think that would make you happy? But dancing makes you happy. Not when you're forced to do it, right? You're getting nervous. You think I'm going to make you do it. I'm not going to make you do it. It's all right. But I'm going to share a story about being happy and things that make you happy and things that are good. This is a story that my father used to tell me. Or I don't know if he used to tell me. He told it to me at least once, and I remember it. It's a story about this kingdom where there is a king who loved soup. And he wanted to get the best, richest soup he could ever find. And so he sent all of his workers out around the countryside to visit all of these different homes to find the best soup ever. So there was this one house. One of the king's workers went into the house and asked them for soup. And in this country, there was soup. People were making soup all the time. And so there's just soup on. And so he walked in and he said, could I try some of your soup? I'm from the king. And the family said, sure. They poured some soup, ladled some soup into the bowl. And the king's worker looked down at that and he just saw. Now, have you, any of you seen, noticed on like a chicken soup how there can be little droplets of sparkly little golden sunshine living on top and just sort of looks, oh, it's so rich and yummy. And he looked down and he just saw this thing. There's so many drops of gold there. He said, oh my gosh, look at all this beautiful, this is a rich soup. Look at all this sunshine. Look at all these drops of sunshine in there. And he tasted it and he said, oh, this is so fantastic. The king is going to love this. I'm going to bring back the king in a week. And the soup is so fantastic. I'm going to tell you, we will pay you one gold coin. The king will pay you one gold coin for every drop of golden sunshine that's in your soup, that's in his bowl. And so he left. And the family looked around and said, no way. They didn't say quite like this. This was in the old days. They said, no wayeth, or something like that. And so they looked down in the bowl and they started counting. 50, 70, 100. Holy cow, we're going to be rich. We're going to 100, 200 coins. This is going to be amazing. Now, the day they were planning on the king coming back, they were making the soup. And they thought, everybody know what that gold is? It's oil or it's butter or it's something like that. And so they said, maybe we can get even more. Picked up a whole stick, two sticks of butter or lard or something, and threw it in and just cooked it up really good. And they said, oh, we're going to be so rich. It's going to be so great. King came, big ceremony. They ladled the stuff into the soup into the bowl. And how many drops of gold do you think were in the soup then? One big, because it all glommed together. One big on the layer on the top around the hole. That was it. One. King looked at his worker and he said, this is the best soup you could find. Said, all right, one gold coin to the family. And that's what they got. Now, there are a lot of lessons here. At least one of the lessons that for my father was, well, we talked about density and surface tension and things like that. But there's also something here about too much of a good thing. So I got one more kind of set of questions for y'all. Because this is about too much of a good thing, too. How many of you like ice cream? How many of you would love it, would be happy, do you think, if you could have ice cream every day? Well, maybe not as much, huh? Yeah, how about if you had ice cream for every meal? Would you be happy? How about if a few people, Rose is still saying, yeah, but not everybody. How about if all you ate was ice cream? You know, that wouldn't be as good then anymore. Maybe it would. Some of us still think that might be good, but the rest of us think not so much. It would be boring. You'd get sick. You wouldn't be healthy. So ice cream, it makes you so happy, but part of it making you happy is when it's, you know, it's not an all-the-time thing. This is what economists would say, they'd start talking about law of diminishing returns and things like that. And you don't have to understand that. Someday you will. We will be talking about that in the service and about what makes us happy and how we can figure out what makes us happy. So I hope you all think a little bit about what makes you happy too. And we will see you later. Go now. We will now accept the morning's offering. Your gifts help us do what we want to do to make us happy and to make more people in the world happy. I'm a philosopher by profession. I'm going to talk a little bit about some philosophies of happiness before I turn things over to David. Sometimes it's hard to tell whether different philosophies about happiness disagree about the fundamental value of happiness, or if they just disagree about how to get there. Compare hedonism with Buddhism. Not kinds of things I normally study in my area, but interesting for us to think about. Buddhism, at least to a first approximation, says we should strive to eliminate desires. Suffering is caused by attachment, or desires, and if we get rid of attachment, we won't be disappointed when we can't hold on to, right, or attain things. If we caricature this, we might say something like the following: if we eliminate desires, we will no longer be sad when we don't get our desires filled. So compare that with hedonism, according to which it's good to enjoy the good things in life. Sounds like valuing something very different from the Buddhist, right? Sort of eliminate attachment and desires, enjoy all the good things. But they both claim to be methods for living a good life. The Dalai Lama has a book titled The Art of Happiness. So to understand the Buddhist achievement of happiness, we need to distinguish attachments from values. Buddhism says we shouldn't be attached to things, but that doesn't mean we can't value things once we have them. And the happiness found in nirvana, according to the Buddhist, is better than the fleeting happiness of desire satisfaction. So the hedonistic view isn't as simple as the caricature either. A reasonable hedonist doesn't think we'll be happy if we pursue only cheap thrills. The reasonable hedonist will recognize that too much short-sighted enjoyment of at least certain of life's pleasures will make it harder or impossible to enjoy them in the future. Think of certain drugs or the thrill of gaming. So here's his question. Are the Buddhists and the hedonists disagreeing about what to value or about how to achieve it? I think they're disagreeing a little bit about both the norms of what's important and about human psychology and the economics of how best to achieve the things that we want. And there are separate ideas here, then. One of them is about what fundamentally I want, and the other is about how I can get there. And there are a lot of questions in between here. Some of the things I should value or want, I should do so because of what they'll let me do in the future. As Dave will point out, figuring out how to answer the questions about what we ought to value and how to get those things is pretty difficult. Sometimes there are easy comparisons to make. For example, we can give up happiness now for more happiness later, and we can model decision procedures to figure out which actions maximize total happiness. But even then, there's the question of whether we've got the same sort of happiness, question about whether my value preferences and how much I should discount, whether I should discount at all future happiness, whether it counts the same as much as happiness right now. It may not be that all preferences are co-measurable. You can put them all together and compare them directly with the same measure. Philosophers, going all the way back to Aristotle and before, have pointed out that the fleeting, endorphin-laden joy we call happiness is only one kind in its category. And it's not clear that what we should be trying to get more of is that. After all, that sort of happiness is pretty cheap to source. It's pretty easy to find, although we often pay additional costs for it later, next morning, or whatever. Aristotle and others, following in this tradition, have said that we should be striving for something more broad, the happiness of having one's desires satisfied, or, even more bigger, general well-being or thriving, which is not just about having our current desires filled, but about having a life in which we have healthy sorts of desires that, when satisfied, lead to more possibility of desire satisfaction. Human flourishing is what we should be striving for. There's a kind of happiness labeled eudaimonia in the Greek. It means thriving kind of happiness. Putting a name to something, though, doesn't help us understand the issue. Questions remain even after the naming. If we're thriving, will we be happy? Or do we at least sometimes need to be unhappy in order to thrive? If there are trade-offs between that immediate happiness as pleasure and general well-being, how do we decide which to prefer? And more broadly, how do we decide the ordering of our preferences associated with well-being? What do we want? What do we care more about? Do we prefer having lots of pleasure? What if I could only get it if I were being deceived or manipulated? Or if I were forced to dance? Or would I in some sense be happier if I knew the truth or if I had my free will, but I wasn't sort of as immediately joyful? The big problem here is that we often don't understand to ourselves what makes us happy. And that's where we turn to empirical study rather than armchair thinking. Empirical study can tell us how to maximize some particular thing we want. For example, tell us when too much of a thing isn't a good thing by our own measures. But it does stop short of telling us what we ought to want in the first place. We have to do some of that ourselves first. Once we're armed with our preferences, economic and psychological science can tell us how to achieve them. But it's not as simple as that either, because we don't know what our desires are first all the time. And the more we learn about how to achieve, what it takes to achieve different preferences and what it's involved, the more we learn about the economics of happiness, the better we can understand the foundational questions, the more we can discover our foundational preferences, those things we want to put in to our economic models. The more we discover about what we thought we understood from the armchair is that we maybe didn't understand things that much at all. And so we advance with some combination of empirical study and honest reflection. And so I will turn it over to Dave, but I want you all to take just a minute first of silent reflection. Think about what makes you happy. And don't think about just directly sort of what makes you immediately happy, like the thing you want, but what kind of happiness do you want? What are your preferences? What are your preference orderings? What do you care most about?
Thank you, Scott. That was a good lead-in. I'm glad you all had time to reflect on Scott's question. And my question now is, are you happy? Let's be a little more scientific about the question, though. The general social survey has been trying to get to this answer for the last 40 years by asking the following question. Taken all together, and I quote from the survey, taken all together, how would you say things are these days? Would you say that you are very happy, pretty happy, or not too happy? In general, the answers are more towards the happy end of the spectrum. If you are a woman, have lots of friends, if you're young or if you're old, if you are married or cohabiting, are highly educated, are healthy, have a high income, are self-employed, have low blood pressure, have sex at least once a week with the same partner. This one I hesitate to say, but are a right-wing voter, are religious, are a member of a non-religious organization, volunteer, take regular exercise, and live in a Western country. It especially helps if you live in Denmark. But what does this mean, are you happy? For many years, after a few failed attempts in the 1800s and the early 1900s, economists have decided that measuring individual happiness was difficult, if not impossible, and even better yet, not even necessary. What was important was being able to predict what choices people would make if prices changed, or if incomes changed, or if the Joneses next door got a new car. We make the choices that make us happy, or that increase our utility, but we don't really need to measure that happiness in order to make the predictions of what you or you or you will do. Plus, it's too hard. Let's just assume that people are motivated to be happy. Let's go a little farther and even assume that a little happiness is good, but a whole bunch more happiness is even better, up to the point where you can have ice cream at every meal. Further, let's not even call this driving force happiness, but instead let's call it utility. For most of the 20th century, economists accepted that people acted to increase their utility. In the simple models, this thing called utility was just assumed to be affected by cars, planes, houses, beef, and all the other things that money could buy, with the added restriction that we only have so much money to spend in the first place. We built elegant models, and Michael will attest to this, we have elegant economic models that could explain anything if we believe the assumptions. But the times, they have been a-changing. Just 2 weeks ago, Vincent from Kansas State spoke before you. Speaking of love and how there may actually be an element of economic irrationality involved in choosing one's soulmate. His talk, by the way, would have been grounds for dismissal had he given it at the University of Chicago in the 1960s. Love could be neatly bundled, according to the Chicago School, in a mathematical model by economists, and all of the messy loose ends that attach themselves to love and marriage and life choices are just so much noise in the model. One chose a life mate, goes the model, by how well he or she helps you to attain cars, planes, houses, and all the rest of it, and also how well you decide to split up the housework. I refer you to Gary Becker's article, A Theory of Marriage, Part 1, that was in the 1973 journal Political Economy for further details. But now economists have chosen to deal with this thing called happiness. There's no end to what we choose to deal with. We could just relabel our axes and call utility happiness, and some have done this. But there seems to be something else at work here as well. As Scott demonstrated with the children, more and more ice cream just not make one any happier, and the unemployment check may not make the unfortunate man or woman without a job happy. So economists have joined philosophers and psychologists and theologians and others in trying to understand how the pursuit of happiness just might influence what we do. But what do we mean by happiness? As we all know, the writers of the Declaration of Independence put it right up there in the first paragraph, right next to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. But what do we mean by happiness? Daniel Nettle, in a 2005 book called Happiness, The Science Behind Your Smile, says there are three levels of happiness. Scott alluded to at least two of these, perhaps three of them. The first is the momentary feelings of joy and pleasure. The second level of happiness is overall contentment with life or life satisfaction. The third level, and a little harder to understand if you're an economist, perhaps not if you're a philosopher, is that the quality of life achieved by fulfilling one's potential or achieving the good life. So going into a little more depth on each of these. We may not have to define what momentary pleasure and joy actually means. These are the sunshine on my shoulder types of moments. When something or someone reaches out and plants a perhaps unexpected kiss of sunshine on your shoulder. John Denver sings of it. Scott spoke of it with the children. Woody Allen's movies often include some variation of the orgasmatron. Even an economist would feel a momentary feeling of pleasure and joy if she won the Powerball jackpot, even though being an economist, she would know better than to buy a ticket in the first place. The second level of happiness reflects an overall contentment with life, and this is what is generally what we generally try to attain in the surveys of general happiness, this overall satisfaction with life. Life satisfaction may be described as happiness on balance. An economist would no doubt build a spreadsheet and put all the goods and all the bads on two different sides of the spreadsheet, but others may just as well have an informal feel for building this spreadsheet to weigh the goods and the bads in their lives. This emotional balance sheet leads us to decide if we are living a good life, all things considered. Bad things do happen. Bad things happen to good people. However, we personally draw up this emotional balance sheet and we rate by ourselves how we do. Are we satisfied? Do the goods outweigh the bads in general? You've all met those disgusting people who are seem to be happy all the time, even though they really have no reason to be happy. Scott Alexander, who's a Unitarian Universalist minister now at Vero Beach in Florida, he's convinced he was born with happy genes. He wrote a sermon dealing with happiness, and he's convinced that he's happy all the time because he has happy genes, and he might be onto something. Those who have studied happiness do find that happiness tends to run in families. As Alexander says in his sermon, sometimes I think I'm simply too stupid to know when I should be miserable, but I can't help it. Okay, the third level of happiness is the one that I'm sure I'll get a C from Scott. But this is the third level of happiness is the quality of life that's achieved by fulfilling one's potential, achieving the good life. And Scott referred to work by Aristotle and earlier philosophers who first started talking about the good life. Arthur Brooks, in his book Gross National Happiness, which he wrote in 2008, terms this the moral quality of life. I think a more encompassing title would drop the moral and say the virtuous quality of life. As I said, Aristotle has written about this quality of life, and over 2,400 years ago, he placed happiness at the very pinnacle of human aspiration. I'm sure the translation isn't exact, but the quote that I have from Aristotle is, "The end towards which men strive in life is happiness." Very important concept. Further, he continues, "We are most happy when we are living a life of virtue." But what the heck is virtue? Aristotle goes back to help us again by defining what he means by virtue. He defines an intellectual virtue. He defines a moral virtue. The intellectual virtue is based on our reasoning ability, in which we recognize and grasp truth from the book I had. I would say Search for Truth as well. But in which we recognize and grasp truth. This might be the truth of art, the truth of science, of prudence, or the truth of right action or wisdom. Aristotle described moral virtue as one's character. That character that makes a man good and that makes him do his work well. And it does bother me to keep saying man, but you know, I'm taking it out of Aristotle, and 2,400 years ago, that's how they wrote. Actually, not all that long ago, that's how they wrote. But the man or woman with moral virtue chooses a careful path between excess and defect. As examples, Aristotle describes moral virtue as arising with temperance. One of the moral virtues. Temperance is the balance between the excess of self-indulgence and the defect of unfeeling austerity. Liberality, another moral virtue. Liberality is the balance between the excess of wasteful extravagance and the defect of being miserly. courage, the path lying between foolhardiness and cowardice, and so on, to define various other aspects of moral virtue. A life of deep and lasting happiness, this good life, as Aristotle describes, can only be obtained by living a life of moral and intellectual virtue, of being, in Aristotle's words, quote, the translation, brave, just, and good, the moral side, and in his own mind, a lover of truth, the intellectual moral side, or virtue side. The focus of happiness studies, such as the General Social Survey, is more on type number two, life satisfaction. Are you satisfied with your life? How people are weighing their outlooks based on the good and bad things that happen to them is the focus of these surveys. And although the field is big and growing bigger, lots and lots of economists are being produced, I'll mention just some of the happiness work in three of the areas. But as I said, there's lots of areas in which happiness is figuring prominently in studies by economists and philosophers and psychologists and others. Gross national happiness, happiness in religion, and happiness in age. So I'll quickly touch upon each of those three. The first is gross national happiness, the title of Arthur Brooks' 2008 book, or the pursuit of happiness from a national perspective. Since 1776, we have made happiness a national pursuit. How are we doing? Well, the results of the GSS study, which is a study based in the United States, the results in 2006 showed that at that time, 13% of the Americans in the survey reported that they were not very happy. 56% said that they were pretty happy, and 31% said that they were very happy. And I tried to find more recent data, but I couldn't, but it wasn't really necessary because these numbers have been relatively unchanged ever since the survey started in 1972. So generally around 30 to 35% of Americans view themselves as very happy, 55 to 60% say they're very happy, or they are pretty happy, and the rest are those who fall into the not at all happy category. You might think that Americans would be the happiest people in the world because we tend to be the richest people in the world. However, this is not so. Mexico and the Danes beat us in one of the surveys taking a look at international comparisons. Up to a certain point, happiness does increase with income. Again, I'm still talking about gross national happiness, but only up to a point. Richard Easterlin wrote a book or an article back in the 1970s where he uncovered this puzzle between income and well-being. Using surveys from 19 developed countries, which is what he based his survey on, Easterlin found that within countries, like within the United States, within France, within Germany, an individual's income and happiness closely matched. In other words, rich Germans tended to be happy, poor Germans, not so much. However, this close tie between average income and average happiness fell apart when you compare different countries and you look at trends over time. The pattern he discovered that average happiness within a country does not increase with average income is called the Easterlin paradox. Easterlin paradox. He did not find a strong linkage across countries and over time between income and happiness. So in Denmark, one of the happier countries, per capita income in 2010 was $58,000, 26% higher than per capita income in the United States, and Danes are happy. No wonder they're happier. No wonder they're happier than us. But according to another study that's reported in the book by Brooks, Mexico, in this one study, had the highest happiness rating, even though their income was 80% lower than the per capita income in the United States. So what's going on? Evidence might support the Easterlin paradox, and happiness may not solely be a function of income. Hard for an economist to say. But another common thread in the comparison of happiness in the United States and in the other countries suggests that it's not just how much money you have, but how you're doing relative to those people you hang out with. Happiness is, in other words, relative. Relative comparisons may explain the higher happiness score in Mexico than in the United States, despite Mexico having a much lower average income than the United States. You would think that this finding, that happiness is relative, would have a negative effect on happiness in the United States, as we increasingly hear of the growing gap between, for example, the top 1% and the rest of us. The merits or the dangers of this increasing income and wealth inequality is certainly a subject for national debate, certainly a subject for perhaps national action. However, basing the argument on how this gap affects happiness is probably not a productive route. Does religion make us happy? Arthur Brooks slices Americans into three groups. About a third of the Americans attend church at least once a week. Another third hardly ever go or don't go at all to a church. And then the last third show up occasionally. Brooks calls the first group religious. The second group he calls secularist. And right away I see problems with how he's defining these different groups. But I'll ignore that for now. Brooks reports studies that find that people who observe a religious connection, be it Christian, Jewish, Muslim, esoteric, or even New Age religions, even presumably you use, were more likely than people without an attachment to religion to identify themselves as being very happy. Brooks tends to be a little biased in his writing. For example, he repeats a study finding that those who were sure that God existed were a third more likely to report that they were very happy than those who do not believe in God, the atheists. Even less happy than these two groups were those without the convictions of the religious or the convictions of the atheist. Only 12% of those who were uncertain of the existence of God reported themselves as being very happy. So conviction is good. The conclusion that Brooks draws is that religion, faith, and spirituality bring happiness. But is it religion that makes religious folks happy? The country happiness scores include what we think of as religious countries, such as Mexico and the United States. But near the top of the list, though, are countries that we might not think of being quite so religious: Great Britain, Denmark, and even godless Sweden does well in the happiness rankings. At the beginning of the talk, I listed some of the factors that tend to influence how happy people feel, amongst them having friends, being part of a social community, being a member of a non-religious organization, volunteering your time and your skills. In this country, going to church or temple or mosque or fellowship can satisfy many of these determinants of happiness. Here at the UUFM, we come together with people we enjoy. We have ample opportunity to be as active as we want in helping this community. Many of you volunteer your skills and your time either directly through UU activities, such as the Happy Kitchen and working the RE program, or in non-religious groups of fellow travelers, such as the League of Women Voters, Foothills Breadbasket, Hospice, and so on. I'm not conducting a survey, but I would imagine that you enjoy these many activities. You derive utility from these activities, and we could probably measure that. But these activities might even make you very happy. And, oh, by the way, since most of you come fairly regularly on Sunday mornings, you're religious, by Brooks's definition. You're religious, and you're happy. And if your search leads you to belief in a higher power, or confirms your disbelief in God, or even raises more questions than are answered, is irrelevant. You are religious, and you are happy. There is an exception, of course, as Brooks points out. In some cases, religion can correlate with unhappiness. Unhappiness tends to result when one's view is of a God who is unloving, judgmental, and controlling. In Brooks's words, if you had a severe hellfire and brimstone upbringing, and you think this made you less happy, you're probably right. Finally, an area I am finding increasingly interesting, and maybe even relevant, is the relationship of happiness and age. Much of the following comments come from an article in The Economist in December of 2010. Life is not a long, slow decline from sunny mountain meadow to the shadows of the valley of death. Instead, life and one's outlook on life is increasingly becoming recognized as a U-turn, or as a U-shaped. Children and young people are happy, but of course they are. And contrary to what we might have believed in the 1970s, though, happiness tends to increase as we grow older. Pete Townsend, show of hands, who knows who Pete Townsend is? Okay, Pete Townsend, he was a guitarist in The Who, wrote these words in My Generation, a fantastic song, which he wrote in his 20s, quite a few years ago. Things they do look awful cold. Hope I die before I get old. Pete's now over 60 years old. And if you visit his blog, he is aglow with happiness and buoyancy. I looked at his blog the other day, and the posting that he posted last fall says he worked like a dog when he was young, just so he could put his feet up and relax now that he is 66. Of course, he's still busy with his music, but he has a little better outlook. He probably does no longer wish that he died before he grew old. Things do go downhill from youth to middle age, the U shape, until they reach the bottom of the U at a time commonly called the midlife crisis. People are least happy in their 40s and their 50s. And this finding has been substantiated across countries, across time, across populations. And although there are differences among people, and there are some differences across countries, people tend to bottom out at a global average age of 46. And then things get better. Really? Arthur Stone and three other of his co-authors did a study breaking happiness or a feeling of well-being down into positive and negative feelings. And they looked at how these emotions change over time. They found that enjoyment and happiness dip in middle age, and then they pick up again. Stress rises during the early 20s, but then it falls sharply. Worry peaks in middle age and falls sharply thereafter. Anger declines throughout life. Sadness rises slightly in middle age and falls thereafter. This turnaround in happiness is surprising based on the commonly held beliefs. Remember Pete Townsend's song, My Generation? When young people look at older people, they think how terrifying it must be to be nearing the end of your life. But older people know what matters most. Although as people move towards old age, they lose things they treasure: vitality, mental sharpness, and for some of us, looks. Older people often gain what people spend their whole lives pursuing: happiness. The author of the Economist article talks of, a quote, the uniquely human ability to recognize our own mortality and monitor our own time horizons. Because the old know they are closer to death, they may grow better at living for the present, focusing on things that matter now, such as feelings, and less on long-term goals. Our goals change as we age. We may give up hoping to become chief executive or have a picture shown at the Royal Academy and learn to be satisfied with being an assistant branch manager or having our watercolor shown at a church fete. Perhaps acceptance of aging itself is a source of relief. William James, an American philosopher, observed in the late 1800s, "How pleasant is the day when we give up striving to be young or slender. Many of us were blessed to be here several years ago when Brock Dale shared the joy one morning that although he had absolutely no basis for feeling that way, he was intensely happy. Brock was at the top of the U. The Economist article closes with a quote, "The aging of the rich world is normally seen as a burden on the economy and a problem to be solved. But the U-bend of happiness argues for a more positive view of the matter. The grayer the world gets, the brighter it can become." Open now for discussion. And Scott is more than willing to come up and answer any philosophical questions you might have.
Thank you, Kathy Hedges. This was delightful. Thank you very much for sharing it. I wanted to add a piece of information that my brother was invited by the King of Bhutan to come and perform there, and their national goal is gross national happiness. They're very, very committed to it. And one example is to put in a dam for hydropower. They built the dam going through a mountain tunneling inside so it did not destroy the landscape. And it says so they get tons of power from it, but it's all inside the mountain.
I did have that in the write-up. Bhutan does have a national policy that not gross national product, but gross national happiness is the goal of their decisions. Projects such as the water hydropower you just mentioned not only must satisfy environmental impact statements, but they must also satisfy national happiness impact statements. Sarkozy in France tried to promote the same approach in considering French projects, and David Cameron in the United Kingdom also tried to promote. I think they were both laughed off the stage. It's not a Western concept.
Michael Oldfather, I've been reading Richard Layard's British economist, labor economist's work. The title of it is Happiness, Lessons from a New Science, and there are lots of interesting things about it. One of the things that he did is similar to what you've talked about here, and that is to review the General Social Survey as well as a whole bunch of them all over mostly Western Europe and the United States, fairly affluent countries, and to get a composite view of what reduces happiness. A lot of time spent on happiness, the idea of utility, of course, but he also looks at the evidence where brain action is monitored that demonstrates clearly when people are doing whatever makes us happy. Don't understand that fully, but I've tried introspection. I don't get it. But anyway, one of the things that's interesting in this compilation from all of these similar surveys is the three things that have the biggest negative impact on happiness when they're taken collectively. Two of them are not surprising. That is that the tied for second in biggest negatives are unemployment and health problems. But I was surprised to see that the very biggest one was being separated, married but separated. It's better to be married and divorced than married and separated. That is the one that apparently is, take all these things together, is the most has the most deleterious effect on happiness. Get it over with, in other words, I guess.
Jim Chanteau. In the area that I actually do research on, we touch at times into a concept which has been introduced primarily by economists into the study of healthcare and healthcare programs called quality of life years, or QOLYs, Q-O-L-Y. I guess it should be QOLYs, but anyway, they call them QOLYs. And so different systems get analyzed by estimating what the qualities will be. Well, it turns out that that's very difficult to pin down. But the question is, you know, if somebody has a medical procedure, how many good years do they have in front of them? I ran into this when I was doing work on organ transplantation. It's a very major procedure, obviously, to have a new heart or a borrowed heart or a borrowed kidney or some other part of your body transplanted. Is it worth it? Well, it depends how many qualities you have after the transplant. In the recent healthcare reform program that was promoted by President Obama, apparently the analysis of qualities is forbidden. You cannot analyze anything by looking at quality of life, which would tend to suggest to me that they're saying that health cannot be analyzed by looking at happiness. That's why I would define the quality. I don't know what to make of this.
Yeah, I have no comment on that other than I agree. I would think that the quality of life would be of utmost importance, at least to the patient and the family.
Sybil Perkins, just to respond to that, I'm not positive that I understood, but it seems to me, from my understanding, is that you would not want to look at that. Say, if you're looking at the value of a transplant based on quality of life after the transplant, I could see where you would not want to bias who you gave a transplant to and who you wouldn't. You wouldn't want to try and measure that ahead of time and make your transplant decision based on that. That seems patently unfair to me. Anyway, where did this survey come from, Dave?
It's a general social survey, and I'm not really sure who conducts it. It's probably some university center somewhere. The data lives at the Michigan Social Science Center. I forget what that's called, but I don't know if they conduct the survey or not. But it's a university survey. But there are a number around the world that are looking at Latin America and Europe and countries in Asia as well. This is the U.S. version.
Well, I understand perfectly why that wasn't permitted, because it would be lead perhaps to the rationing of health services. To me, it makes perfectly good sense to decide, since you can't give heart transplants to everybody, that you don't give them to somebody who's not going to live very long afterwards or not be able to do anything. When instead of giving it to somebody who has a better chance of getting some results, and in fact, that is what happens in those transplant centers. That they do, even if they're not supposed to. It's my understanding anyway. They weigh how it's going to work and whether it's going to work and lead to quality of life. But I'm sure that the reason it didn't get in that they just knew they couldn't pass it. If they faced the fact that what we really do is to, at end-of-life decisions, that we decide not to prolong a life that has no particular high quality of life. So we can't do all the medical services that people could possibly want. There's just no way we can live with that, so we have to make some rational decisions about who's going to get it, and people are not going to like it.
Harriet Yonke, at Meadowlark, of course, we have various issues of life and death and prolonging life and whether or not to, we've had meetings about living wills and durable power of attorney and stuff so your kids can make decisions for you. And so I was talking with our Dr. Joe Slagic, our doctor there at Meadowlark, and I was telling him, I said, once I get dingy, I don't want to be around. I want to be gone. And I said, if I get pneumonia or something and I'm dingy, let me go. Don't give me penicillin. And he said, well, tell your kids. He says, I had a 95-year-old lady who'd had dementia for years and years, and they weren't going to treat her because pneumonia is the old person's best friend. And in that instance, and the son came in, and he wanted his 95-year-old mother to stay alive, even though she didn't know him, didn't know anything. And so it's you kids that have got to face the facts that there is an end of life. But then about a month and a half later, I got pneumonia. So I tried really hard not to forget anything when I was talking to my kids.
Did you tell anybody?
Marilyn Caldwell. I'm right now in probably the happiest time of my life. I have good friends and sunshine and a nice house and really good circumstances. But I can say there's, in my long life, there's been four things that really take away the quality of life. Anger, grief, fear, and intense pain. And I've lived through all, come out the other side, and I'm happy.
Thanks. Pat Embers. I was interested in what you said about the virtues of Aristotle, about the intellectual and the moral virtues being leading to the virtues of happiness, I understood that. And I don't know if I missed something else, but that doesn't cover a whole lot. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot missing there. And maybe it came out again, but I just was thinking about the arts and about just intuitional happiness or, you know, spirituality or whatever. Mm-hmm. That bring those maybe less data-oriented kinds of things that we can take real data on, but there are many kinds of avenues, I think, in that realm.
Yeah, that's a good point that Brooks raises, and as the economist, I'll speak first, and then I'll let Scott have an opportunity. But what Brooks talks about in his book is this third living the virtuous life approach is not inconsistent with somebody who is totally depressed and totally unhappy. You can still lead a virtuous life, moral and intellectually, and still, from all outward appearances, be very unhappy. So he had a little bit of trouble with that as well. Scott, do you want to? He's more of an Aristotle expert than I am.
Actually, I don't work on Aristotle, though, so there's not much more I can say, but except that to say that, you know, there are many virtues, and even if Aristotle didn't label certain things as virtuous, all right, one could add other ones, all right, and there are the moral and intellectual versions of finding the truth and doing the right thing or being the right kind of person who does the right kind of thing, but if one wants to, you know, incorporate a lot more, right, as virtuous, leads to thriving, to flourishing, to well-being, right, to a good living. So,
yeah, I guess the idea would be live a virtuous life, reach life balance, number two, and have an orgasmatron in the basement. I didn't say that. our closing. Go ahead.
I just, Mike Benella, I just wanted to point out that you really just bum me out telling me I haven't hit rock bottom yet as a 41.
But it gets better.
I'll look forward to that, but I just through recent experience, I'm disappointed to find out I haven't hit rock bottom yet.
Yeah, it's an average.
Maybe.
Yeah, and it's an average. You might have hit rock bottom at 24. So you might be on that upward swing now. The closing hymn is Simple Gifts, which is number 16, I believe. However, there are more verses than our hymnal reports, so you'll find the additional verses in the handout that accompanied your program. And I think we have time to sing it all. So it's Sam, is you're able? Closing words were written by John Dryden in 1685 from a poem he entitled Happy the Man. Happy the man, and happy he alone, he who can call today his own. He who, secure within, can say, tomorrow do thy worst, for I have lived today. Be fair or foul, or rain or shine, the joys I have possessed, in spite of fate, are mine. Not heaven itself upon the past has power, but what has been, and I have had my hour. Go in peace.